content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Economist, first, of February 9th, Agatha's Ambivalence, When Saintly Commemorations Turn Sour. An Italian Saint's Day has an exuberant side and a dark one. Saint Agatha has an important place in the history of the Christian Church. She is believed to have been a young woman of noble birth who was martyred, after terrible tortures, under the Roman Emperor Decius in 251 AD. Apart from in her native Sicily, she is revered in the Basque Country, Germany's Black Forest, and in Malta. She is one of seven female martyrs of the early Church, whose regular mention is prescribed in the traditional form of the Catholic Mass. Sociologically, and even economically, Agatha still matters. In her hometown of Catania, the annual rituals in her honor stretch over several days in early February, and they rank among the biggest festivals in the Catholic world. They are perhaps the main reason why Sicily can attract visitors in winter. But a respected 83-year-old priest has come to the conclusion that the Church should sever all ties with this noisy exuberance. In the view of Father Salvatore Resca, the festivities are incorrigibly tainted by activities that have no spiritual connection: gambling, cruelty to animals, and petty and not-so-petty criminality. Quote, "There is no more religion in this celebration," he says. "It stopped being a Christian feast decades ago." As his words indicate, the perceived corruption of the event is a relatively recent phenomenon. In living memory, the festival had milder associations in local minds, nuns singing ancient hymns, and an array of sweet delicacies baked in Agatha's honor. It has taken courage for this priest, the second-ranking cleric in one of Catania's main churches, to speak out. He recalls that after airing his views in a local newspaper last year, quote, "I received dozens of death threats, even bullets in my mailbox." Among the high points of the festivities is the moment when a statue of the saint, in a silver casket containing part of her relics, are brought out of the local cathedral and paraded around the city's neighborhoods. In years past, especially in the 1990s, the organizers of this event had clear criminal ties. As a long judicial investigation lasting from 2008 to 2015 confirmed, in more recent times, the Church has tried to reassert some control over the proceedings and to boost the influence of more decent citizens. Not with complete success, though. Prominently involved in this year's ritual, until his name was struck off the list, was a man who was convicted in 2014 of usury. The cleanup has not really worked, as Father Resca has concluded with a heavy heart. People still take bets on the duration of the statue's tour of the city. That is one of the many shady and lucrative businesses that thrive around the ritual. And the ubiquitous sale on the street of sizzling chunks of horse meat, now a standard feature of the festival, is another reminder of dark forces not far away. Last year, the track in Palermo, another Sicilian city where Agatha is revered, suspended all racing and emptied its stables after police found evidence of illegal gambling and rigged contests. And many horses never make it to a proper stable. They're kept in backstreet locations used in, quote, informal races, and sent for slaughter when they're exhausted or injured. Dario De Luca, a Catania-based journalist, says February, either side of the feasts, the saint's feast day on February 5th, is now the time of year when criminal influence over the city is most palpable. Good people have tried to change this. A committee for the legality of the Feast of St. Agatha was formed recently with the aim of cleaning up the proceedings, but Father Resca declined to join. He believes the Church should make a definitive break. As he puts it, the problem is that they still think it's a religious feast. The real turning point will come when they admit that it's now just a pagan event. Some practicing Catholics in Catania seem to agree with him, and they make a point of staying far away from these festivities. But for the townspeople, who are simply out to enjoy the fun, this is still an event not to be missed. They march exuberantly behind the statue as it makes its peregrination around the streets, bellowing out a slogan supposedly of loyalty to Agatha in Sicilian dialect. Siamo tutti devoti. We are all your devotees. This is an extreme case of a common phenomenon all over the world and throughout history. Spiritual authorities have struggled with mixed success to keep control of pilgrimages, saints' days, and other high points in the religious calendar. They do not want to seem like killjoys, and yet they do not want to collude with activities that make a mockery of their doctrines. And sometimes, in Father Resca's brave view, the appropriate thing would be to give up the struggle. And now from the Religion News Service of February 8th, Red Letter Christians, a Christian group, plans a, quote, revival to protest toxic evangelicalism. A group of progressive evangelicals and other Christians are planning a revival this spring to protest toxic evangelicalism and evangelical leaders such as Jerry Falwell Jr., who support President Trump. Christian author and activist Shane Claiborne announced the event on Twitter Wednesday, February 7th, saying he and others plan to host a Red Letter Revival on April 6th and 7th in Lynchburg, Virginia, the same city where Liberty University, a conservative Christian school led by Falwell, is located. Claiborne, co-director of the progressive Christian group Red Letter Christians, told Religion News Service he's heard Liberty students say they want their school, quote, to be known for its love for Jesus rather than its love for Trump. Specifics for the event remain tentative, but he said the program would begin that Friday with a three-hour, hype-filled, fiery, beautiful worship service with preaching. The next day would include a whole bunch of different breakout sessions and music, and conclude with another big service Saturday evening, including a call to action. Going to be epic, tweeted Claiborne. A separate statement emailed to RNS by a Red Letter Christians official did not mention Falwell or Trump by name, but highlighted the target audience for the event. In word, worship, and witness, this revival of Jesus and justice will stand in stark contrast to the distorted Christian nationalism that many white evangelical leaders have become known for, the statement reads in part. It is a gathering for people of faith or no faith who are curious about Jesus and troubled by the state of evangelicalism in America. It was not immediately clear what the call to action Claiborne mentioned would be, but the announcement comes as tensions continue to escalate between Falwell and more progressive Christians deeply critical of his steadfast support for Donald Trump. In an action Liberty officials defended as an attempt to maintain safety and security, evangelical speaker Jonathan Martin was removed from the campus when he visited to attend a concert in October shortly after calling for a peaceful protest of the school. Days later, Claiborne and others published an open letter in November challenging Falwell to a religious debate and accusing him of contributing to a conflation of the Lord's gospel and the religion of white supremacy. Falwell, for his part, has ardently defended Trump since 2016, calling him a dream president for evangelicals. More than 80% of white evangelicals voted for Trump, and many consider him a champion of their values, including their opposition to abortion. In 2017, when the president was embroiled in controversy for saying that blame for the deadly violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, fell on, quote, both sides, meaning white supremacists and counter-protesters, Falwell declared that President Donald Trump does not have a racist bone in his body. In January, when allegations surfaced that Trump had had an extramarital affair in 2006 with a porn star and paid her to keep quiet, Falwell told CNN, "We are all equally bad. We are all sinners." He's also drawn a distinction between what he believes is a Christian's personal responsibility and the responsibility of government, tweeting last month that, quote, Jesus said, love our neighbors as ourselves, but never told Caesar how to run Rome. Claiborne did not offer any official statement about whether attendees will directly confront Liberty officials during the revival, but the outspoken author is no stranger to dramatic demonstrations. For example, he was arrested in December for participating in a prayer-based protest in Washington, D.C. to express support for legislation that would protect immigrants who were brought to the United States by their parents when they were children. Other faith leaders critical of Falwell are also scheduled to be part of the revival. Claiborne said the festivities will include an address by the Reverend William Barber II, a leading figure on the religious left, and organizer of the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina. Barber co-signed the letter calling for a debate with Falwell and has repeatedly criticized prominent evangelicals who support Trump. Although the event is being held near Liberty University, Claiborne said, quote, "We are not there to vilify Jerry Falwell Jr. We're up there to lift up Jesus, and that itself is the critique of toxic evangelicalism." Still, Claiborne acknowledged the impetus for the event is partly rooted in criticism of Liberty, including by Liberty students and alumni frustrated by the perception that the school inherently supports the president, who was its commencement speaker last May. Claiborne was quick to note that the event is being organized in cooperation with local Lynchburg clergy, two of whom are mentioned in the news release. He also hinted at possible participation by unnamed students and faculty at Liberty. "We are building on some of the movement locally and different leaders there," he said. "We don't really want it to be just outside people coming in." The Red Letter Christians statement names other leaders expected to attend, including author and pastor Tony Campolo, also of Red Letter Christians, author Lisa Sharon Harper, founder of Freedom Road, the Reverend Brenda Brown Grooms, pastor of New Beginnings Christian Community and minister with the Charlottesville Clergy Collective, and the Reverend S. Todd Yeary, pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church in Baltimore and political action chair of the Maryland State Conference NAACP. Claiborne said organizers are also reaching out to several musicians to ask about their participation, such as John Foreman of the band Switchfoot and Christian hip-hop artists Lecrae and Micah Bournes. He said he hopes the result will lift up a different evangelical voice than that of Falwell and others. "When evangelicals have lost our focus on Jesus, we end up talking a lot about things Jesus didn't talk about and a lot of things and supporting things that are a direct contradiction to Matthew 25, he said, referencing Jesus' call to help the vulnerable in the Bible. Liberty University did not immediately return a request for comment on the story. And now an article in a slightly different format from the Religion News Service's Bart Ehrman's latest book, How Christianity Took Over the World. New Testament scholar Bart Ehrman became a superstar on the heels of his popular trade books debunking long-held assumptions about Christian scriptures, with titles like How Jesus Became God, Forged, and Misquoting Jesus. He gained a devoted following of fellow agnostics, atheists, and ex-Christians. They may not appreciate the title of his newest book, The Triumph of Christianity, How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World, which is set to be released on Tuesday, February 13th. In it, Ehrman tries to explain a long, puzzling historical drama. How did 20 or so Jesus followers come to convert much of the world in the space of 300 years? Sociologist Rodney Stark published a book with the same title in 2011. Most of the research into the first few centuries after Jesus' crucifixion around the year 33, he concedes, is not new. Scholars have been grappling with how Christianity exploded onto the scene for a long time. Ehrman's goal is to bring that issue to the masses in plain English, marshaling the evidence, most of it written originally in Greek and Latin, and crunching the numbers. True to form, Ehrman, a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, doesn't exalt in Christianity's success, despite his new book's title. "In this book, I've tried to explain the triumph of Christianity without making it a triumphalist narrative," he writes. As someone who has written 20 books for lay readers, Ehrman may know something about what titles are likely to sell. RNS caught up with Ehrman before he left for Washington, D.C. to give four lectures as part of a sold-out Smithsonian Associates program on Saturday. He will also give a reading on politics and prose on Sunday, the 11th. And the following interview has been edited for length and clarity. Question: why did you focus on this particular area of Christian history? Answer: the thing that struck me was how significant this Christian revolution was. Christianity became the most powerful institution in the Western world. My question in the book is, how did that happen? How do you get from 20 insignificant, illiterate, lower-class day laborers in a remote part of the empire to 30 million people and end up being the most influential power in the West? I've always thought it was a very important question, and the book tries to answer it. Question. You conclude that the conversion of Roman Emperor Constantine to Christianity in the year 312 was not the signal event that led to Christianity's rise. Please explain this. Answer. What I came to realize is that it probably would have happened whether or not Constantine converted. If you actually plot the growth of Christianity, you realize it's an exponential curve. Christianity is gaining a few people early on, and they're gaining massive numbers of people later on. It's like investments. The rate of growth ends up creating huge amounts of money later when you have a lot of money. Earlier, when there's just a little bit of money, there's a little bit of growth. Question. Christianity appealed to pagans, you write, because of its emphasis on miracles. Why? Answer. One thing pagans have in common is that they're worshiping the gods because of the benefits gods can provide. The gods can make sure that it rains, that crops grow, livestock reproduces. They can protect women in childbirth, heal people that are sick. It's all about divine power. If Christians are going to convert people away from the religious practices they've been involved in for millennia, it has to be because your divine power is more effective than theirs. The way you show the Christian God is more powerful than other gods is by showing that he does miracles. And you have to show people that his miracles are superior. That's what the Christians do. Question, are there any lessons in that about the growth of Christianity in Africa and Asia? Answer, it's interesting that liberal Christianity in America, as we think of it, tends to be more rational and less interested in supernatural displays of power, healing miracles, or speaking in tongues. That kind of liberal Christianity simply doesn't have much influence on the wider world. The places that are converting are where you get these very conservative Christian groups going in who have no trouble talking about miracles happening. I suspect it's a similar phenomenon. Question. You write about how Christianity went from being persecuted to being persecutors of pagans and Jews. Do you see modern parallels? Answer. A lot of people have the image of early Christianity being a constantly persecuted faith, and that Christianity was declared illegal, and so they had to go into hiding and hung out in the catacombs of Rome. When you actually look at the evidence, you see the persecution was actually very sporadic, and fairly rare and regional. What Christians talk about it is that they were constantly being persecuted, and that is a very clear modern analogy. My Christian students in Chapel Hill sometimes talk about how persecuted they are. These are upper middle class kids from North Carolina who live in a Christian culture where Christianity has the power, and they feel persecuted. It's interesting that someone doesn't actually have to be persecuted to feel persecuted, and that was certainly the case in early Christianity. Question, you have a reputation of being the debunker of Christian dogma, but now you're talking about its triumph. Is that a contradiction? Answer, as a historian, I'm neutral about good or bad. If Christianity hadn't taken over, something else would have happened. History would have gone on. But history would have been incalculably different. There are certain aspects of the triumph of Christianity that everyone can appreciate. Just in terms of culture, think of art. If Christianity hadn't taken over, we wouldn't have had Leonardo or Michelangelo, or in music, philosophy, literature. We're all grateful we have this fantastic cultural heritage. On the other hand, a lot was lost when Christianity triumphed. Thousands of pieces of pagan art were destroyed. Pagan literature is lost to posterity. So a lot was gained in the triumph of Christianity, and a lot was lost, and certainly effectively was a triumph. But whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, I think people can have different evaluations about that. Question, in your books, you try to explain historical methods. Why is that important? Answer, I started to think it was important when I first did my work on the historical Jesus. I had read book after book published for a popular audience by scholars in which the scholar laid out what he thought we could say about the historical Jesus, but he never explained how he got there, how he was using his materials to come to his conclusions, because they weren't obvious historical conclusions. So when I wrote my book on the historical Jesus, I thought, I'm going to explain how exactly I'm getting here. Question, what next for you? Answer, my next step has a very loose connection with the triumph of Christianity. Before Christians came along, most pagans had no idea that their religion was going to affect what happened after they died. A lot of pagans thought that when you died, that was the end of the story. You just ceased to exist. Christians came along and said, no, there's a heaven and hell, and you're going to go to one place or the other. If you believe in Christ, you'll go to heaven. If you reject Christ, you'll be tormented eternally. This was a very effective evangelistic tool. And what the Christians did was that they invented a need that pagans didn't know they had. This idea of your soul going to heaven or hell is certainly not taught in the Old Testament, and it wasn't taught by Jesus. So why do Christians have this idea? Jesus didn't think that when your soul died, it went to one place or the other in eternity. But that's what Christians think. So my question is, where did that come from? My next book is going to be on the invention of the afterlife. And now from the Associated Press of February 9th, Native American spirituality. A Native church's lawsuit spurs training for airport screeners. A wooden box carried an eagle feather and a bone whistle, a gourd rattle, and a feather fan, items that carry spiritual energy and are used in Native American religious ceremonies. The man holding the box asked security agents at the San Antonio International Airport to allow him to display the items so that their energy wouldn't be polluted. The agents declined, roughly handling the items and shoving them back into the box. According to Sandor Iron Rope, former president of the Native American Church of North America, his lawsuit against the Transportation Security Administration was settled last month, with neither side acknowledging fault and the agency agreeing to better educate its employees about Native American religious items at more than a dozen airports nationwide. There was a policy in place designed to provide some protection for us, but they don't have training, Iron Rope said Wednesday. Not everybody is familiar with the policies. And the TSA did not respond to messages seeking comment. The Native American Church has multiple chapters around the country and an estimated 250,000 members. The church that was formed in 1918 blends Native American beliefs and Christianity, but doesn't have formal buildings. Instead, its members meet in teepees for lengthy ceremonies and use peyote as a sacrament. Its most visible legal battles have been over peyote, a hallucinogenic that only grows naturally in the United States in southern Texas. States had varied laws on Native Americans' use of the cactus until the early 1990s, when a federal law allowed Native Americans who were part of the church to possess peyote. For anyone else, it's illegal in the same category as heroin and cocaine. Membership cards cite the federal law and another that allows Native Americans to possess migratory birds. One of Iron Rope's attorneys, Forrest Tadunipa, said church members have had enough bad experiences to discourage them from air travel. He said Iron Rope had no indication agents believed his ceremonial items were dangerous. That's part of the reason we felt there should have been a lawsuit in the first place, he said. Screening of items should be reserved for things TSA has a legitimate suspicion are going to be a danger to traveler safety. Passengers can do their part by alerting the TSA at least 72 hours in advance to carry on items that need additional screening and by clearly communicating beliefs, said Richard Bloom, director of Terrorism Intelligence and Security Studies at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott, Arizona. Security agents cannot be trained in all religions, but he said they can improve on dealing with the unknown. A little bit of sensitivity and respect and really being open to the unique needs of a religious individual can go a long way toward negotiating something that works for the individual and for the TSA, Bloom said. Not all religious items would be allowed on planes with passengers, however. The TSA prohibits religious knives like the kirpan. Sikhs who carry them do not view them as weapons or accessories, but as extensions of their being and their belief that they are protectors of the weak. The Sikh Coalition, a civil rights organization, has issued travel guidelines alerting the community that kirpans can be in checked baggage only, and the faithful generally adhere. But the coalition has represented at least one Sikh man who was charged for carrying kirpans through airport security, and the case was eventually dropped. As part of the settlement with the Native American Church of North America, the TSA and the plaintiffs will collaborate on a webinar that will be available to agents who work with passengers well ahead of their flights to move items through security. Those webinars will be shown to TSA employees in Albuquerque and Farmington, New Mexico, Durango, Colorado, Great Falls, Montana, Mino, North Dakota, Rapid City and Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and San Antonio, Laredo, and McAllen, Texas. Certain TSA employees in St. Paul, Minnesota, Omaha, Nebraska, Oklahoma City, Phoenix, and Denver will have to review guidelines for screening Native American religious items. A fact sheet for travelers with Native American religious items will be published in the next 3 months, and the church will be able to advise and make recommendations to the TSA. We're hopeful that we'll have a place at the table now so that any future concerns will be addressed more quickly and more efficiently than through a lawsuit, said Iron Tree. Back to The Economist now of February 5th. Advertising and faith. A European court vindicates a fashion designer whose images upset Catholics. A court victory for a designer accused of blasphemy. This week, the European Court of Human Rights handed out a verdict which law and religion pundits will be pondering for years to come. It vindicated Sekmadienis, a company selling the work of Robert Kalinkin, a Lithuanian fashion designer. The seller had been fined for using images of Jesus and the Virgin Mary, which Catholics found offensive. The case refers to a Kalinkin campaign in 2012, which featured a bare-chested young man and a woman, both with halos. The man was sporting jeans and tattoos, and the female figure wore a white dress with a string of beads. The caption consisted of lines such as, "Jesus, what trousers," and "Dear Mary, what a dress," and "Jesus, Mary, what are you wearing?" After receiving some complaints about the images, Lithuania's State Consumer Protection Agency, SPCA, consulting the bishops of the Catholic Church, to which nearly 80% of Lithuanians adhere, this led to Sekmadienis being fined 580 euros, or about $725, for, among other things, quote, "encouraging a frivolous attitude toward the ethical values of the Christian faith." This week's ruling by the ECHR, an organ of the 47-nation Council of Europe, found that the company's freedom of expression had been violated. It accepted that liberty of expression carried certain responsibilities, including a duty not to be gratuitously offensive or profane, but it considered that the images in question did not fall into that category. It noted that freedom of expression extended to ideas which offend, shock, or disturb. There are several striking features in this case. The terms in which Lithuania's SPCA denounced the images have a weirdly theocratic ring about them. It said that images promote a lifestyle which is incompatible with the principles of a religious person. That is a peculiar line of argument for a government agency in a secular democracy to use. It's hardly surprising that the ECHR struck it down. On the other hand, the ECHR's reasoning also has elements which some observers will find strange. Libertarians may find the court too willing to accept the principle that offensive and profane images might in some cases merit prosecution. Others will be surprised by the court's confidence in its own authority to judge the presence or absence of profanity in particular images. To an American legal mindset, this could smack of an unwholesome blurring of the lines between church and state authority. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.